maybe you've been interested in this other aspect as I have. Some of the commentators have noted or claimed or proclaimed that Michael Jackson will in fact be the last celebrity of this caliber because, you know, he came of age and became famous in a time of less media splintering, whether you're talking about just three television networks or and no internet and just, you know, a handful of huge music companies, you know, that could put their muscle behind one guy, you know, and put him out there all over the world. I guess someone slipped into the conversation recently, this tidbit, that the album Thriller, one reason why it was so big was it was launched, you know, it was released on the same day all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's extremely rare, apparently. And this was one reason why he became intercontinental.
That's true.
And it's very interesting. And apparently this isn't done anymore because of blah, 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 you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sick of hearing about nothing ever done anymore the way it used to be done.
Oh,
but
yeah.
They're saying, you know, you're not going to have anyone that big anymore. Have you picked up on this?
I have a little bit. And you know what? It ties into a theory of mine because, again, and this is something I've talked about. And, again, I'm a guy who I've never been like a big pop music guy. I'm way more of a rock guy, whatever. So the most popular music of this decade, some of the stuff like that, you know, I don't listen to top 40 stations. So
yeah.
I can tell you what, I know that the Jonas Brothers and Taylor Swift and that kind of stuff, that's like as big as it gets. Chris Brown, I couldn't name you one of their tunes, any of these guys, because I've been able to isolate myself from them. In the 80s, in order to listen to Michael Jackson or Van Halen or whatever, you had to sit through Culture Club and other stuff. These stations were more intermingled. I agree with that point because somebody like me, I can isolate myself from stuff I don't like. People can do that. It is a much more fragmented world, Adam. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. You make a good point that just the way things were spread out more evenly and more available, there was a certain ubiquity.
Mm-hmm.
You know when like either an oldie station or perhaps a light music station that plays older songs will play, I don't know, songs from the 80s or the 70s that you still remember by heart, even if you didn't even like them. You know?
You know,
I mean,
what?
It's just interesting how ubiquitous things used to be. And you're right. We all know, you pass a newsstand, you're going to hear about these Jonas Brothers, whoever they are.
Yeah.
You know, not to sound like an old guy. But you're right. I have no idea what their songs are. And their songs are really only of interest to 12 to 15-year-old girls, probably.
Yeah.
And after they grow out of that, they're probably not going to care anymore. I don't know if they'll be listening to the Jonas Brothers in 20 years.
Probably not. That you know, that's the thing. You know, again, at that age, I couldn't duck the bubblegum music because it was so intertwined with the other stuff. Now I can. Now everybody can. It is a different, you know, day and age. And I think that's part of it, too, when you look at the landscape. And I tell you what I want to ask you about also, too, in terms of ubiquity and being able to, you know, follow stuff here. You've written recently, you wrote about, as did, you know, I think a lot of people in TV, about the Tonight Show transition with Conan O'Brien taking over. And again, you could make the analogy, as we've been talking about Michael Jackson and the universality of him. That was Johnny Carson at one point in time because he had the late night landscape. There was no fragmenting of any serious nature until the late 80s when you'd see a little Arsenio and you'd see some of these, you know, minnows who would try to fashion themselves as competitors. Now it's full-on late night competition. I had theorized at the outset of this, and I realized that it was an outlandish theory, perhaps, but in looking at this, I said, you know what? If Conan struggles at all in the ratings here, and if Leno struggles to get traction at 10 o'clock, because that's a massive experiment on the scale we've never seen before, is it the weirdest thing in the world to say that in a year or two they return to the status quo ante? I wonder if there's even the remotest possibility of that.
You mean putting Leno back at late night?
Back at 11:30. I think Conan would be SOL because I don't think Fallon's going anywhere. But, you know, I wonder.
Let me put it this way, Rick.
Uh-huh.
And I can't conjure any examples, but I know this to be true.
Okay.
That sometimes it has come to pass that networks will behave unpredictably.
Okay.
That would be the unpredictable outcome. From everything that I've been told, they are committed to this Leno thing come hell or high water at least for a year.
Okay.
I mean, his ratings could disappear, and they would allegedly, this is what they said, allegedly it'll stay on for the year. Whether they'll ever restore him to the Tonight Show, I just don't know. I think maybe another scenario would be if somehow it doesn't work for Leno at 10, then maybe one of the other networks finally grabs him.
And then NBC.
Like that scenario where ABC was going to get him.
Interesting. And, you know, NBC, of course, was terrified of going up against him. Is it possible that after a year or two of lackluster numbers at 10 o'clock, they might feel a little bit better? Like, hey, he's not as hot as he was when he was coming off of the Tonight Show. Maybe he couldn't do us in as much damage going up against Conan. You suppose they might look at it that way?
They might look at it that way. On the other hand, NBC seems content with lower ratings generally. And their mantra has been in recent seasons, as the ratings has dropped, they've said or claimed, well, we're making money hand over fist anyway. It's a business model that works for us. It's about demographic strength. It's not about mass numbers anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their cynical competitors, such as CBS, would say, well, they're only saying that because they're not in the game of mass audiences anymore.
Right.
They've abdicated. And when they do get mass audiences for something like the Olympics, they brag about it.
Right.
So, you know, it's a little hard to know when they're telling you the truth, which is only part of the time. This is the most fascinating story upcoming in television, which is the 10 o'clock Jay Leno thing.
Yep.
And how it has affected the scheduling for 10 p.m. shows. And then there's just the issue of Jay himself. You know, Jay's a real winning guy. You know, he goes around acting as if he doesn't care. But he really does, and he works his ass off.
Yep.
And he's got this comedy thing down to a science. He reminds me of Merv Griffin. You know, Merv did the blandest entertainments you could imagine, and it was on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him saying on the Larry King show once, you know, Larry, I made a TV show out of that paper game you play called Hangman.
Uh-huh.
You know, Wheel of Fortune. And it was the simplest, most bland thing he could come up with. And he knew it would succeed because it was so simple. And Leno is sort of the same way. Tell a simple joke, get check, and go home. And it's really worked for him. I thought it was wrong of them to drop him from late night. I thought it was just not the right thing to do. I don't think it was time to do it. And what was always puzzling to us people who covered the business was what was this big faith they had in Conan? What was so great about Conan that if Conan got angry and left, what does NBC care?
Well, ultimately, in 2004 and in 2008, weren't they in both instances motivated by fear? In 2004, they were motivated by fear of Conan going somewhere and beating down Leno. And then in 2008, it was like, oh, holy crap, what if Leno, you know, we didn't know if Leno would still have traction 4 or 5 years later. He does. God forbid he goes to ABC or Fox or syndication,
yeah,
or something like that. So it was fear both times, wasn't it, Adam?
Yeah, there's that. I mean, they had different reactions each time. I think you're right to some extent. In 2004, I'm not sure they thought, for whatever reasons I can't fathom, that Leno might not have been as strong in 2008 and 2009. And I think there's another fear, though, which is that, let's say they kept Leno on until he was, I don't know, 65 or 67,
mm-hmm,
and then he didn't look as good. Maybe he started to lose it a little bit, like Johnny did. You know, you might remember Johnny whistling through his false teeth and stuff like this. I mean, you know, it was time for Johnny to go, whether anybody likes to hear it or not. But he was a lot older than Leno. And maybe they would have felt, well, you know, this is really delicate. We got to ease out Jay, and we don't have anybody. Because the guy we were training back then was this Conan guy. Of course, on the other hand, if Leno was 65, it'd be 7 years from now or whatever it is, or 5 years.
That's
six
true.
6 years, whatever, however old he is. Which means someone else might have been groomed. That's the other thing. You know, I'm sort of old-fashioned about show business. Keep the show going as long as you can, and when it's done, hire the next superstar.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And don't worry about it 5 years in advance.
A lot of guys are interchangeable. You're right about that. The thing that's interesting, too, though, about NBC, and it's always fascinating to see what the struggling down on its luck network likes to do. They're a little experimental, it seems to me, in the sense of what they're trying to do to get hits. Not just the Jay Leno thing, but I look at it that, again, what has become my favorite show of all time the last couple of years is The Office. And they've embraced it. They've built around it, and it is anything but a cookie-cutter show as far as how it goes about that.
Its ratings are low.
Yeah. It's not a blockbuster in the conventional sense of the 9 o'clock shows of Thursdays past. I mean, It's by their standards now, it's great, but it's not great by those historical standards.
Well, yeah, they got a very strong, affluent, upscale kind of demographic for it that they can sell.
Yep.
But you're right. And their detractors say there's too much of this. There's too much of this experimentation. You know, everything looks different all the time. What are you really? But on the other hand, you know, it's all smoke and mirrors. CBS, if you had in a couple of words describe CBS, you'd probably say, well, you know, old-fashioned sitcoms on Monday, kind of grotesque, violent police procedurals every other day.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they are. You turn it on at any time and there's some dark horror going on.
Right.
And ABC has this kind of like Ugly Betty, Desperate Housewives vibe.
Yeah.
Where everything is sort of like a garish cartoon.
That's true.
You know? And Fox, I guess, Fox is American Idol and you know, stuff like that. And I guess it's American Idol in house.
It's kind of a mishmash.
Yeah. But they succeed at it because American Idol is as big as the Super Bowl now. So, you know, NBC is interesting. And the other thing about NBC is it's such a diverse company.
Oh,
it
is.
They own all those cable channels. And, you know, if you look at USA Network, they're carrying the kinds of shows that NBC used to carry.
Yeah, they're great
shows.
You know,
kind of these hour dramas based on, like, a couple of hip characters or something, you know?
Right.
Or a detective or a this or a that, you know what I mean?
Right.
That used to be the stuff that networks ran.
Yeah, too bad the mothership isn't as imaginative as, you know, the USA programmers.
Well, I think a lot of people are finding that they like those old shows, those old styles. People love that Kira Sedgwick show, The Closer, on TNT.
That's true.
You know, and the Holly Hunter one, you know.
And NBC, again, because of, you know, struggling and being experimental and stuff, I was almost shocked that, especially because the ratings weren't like a blow-away type thing, that Parks and Recreation still got greenlit as a big part of Thursday nights this fall, because I'll tell you how I looked at it. Again, I went in, and I'm a big Office guy, so I was like, I was watching, and I was like, I like this. I not love it like The Office, I like this. I'm thinking, I like this, but I wonder how many people get this. I wonder how many people are going to think this isn't too slow-paced and boring and subtle and whatever. So I liked it, but was dubious that it would have a mass following. Somehow it made it past, you know, the six-episode phase here. But it kind of shows you where NBC's at, because it's the attitude almost seems to be, well, what other cards do we have to play right now?
Well, there's another thing about the NBC DNA, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is the sheer power of Saturday Night Live.
Right.
And Rick, you may know this even better than I. I don't really recall if Lorne Michaels is involved in this Amy Poehler sitcom, the Parks and Recreation.
I don't think he is directly. I think they pulled a couple people like Michael Schnurr off The Office. That's about it.
But you see, Amy is from there.
Yeah.
And you know, yeah, she's been funny in some of her movies, like that Baby Mama movie was diverting when I saw it on HBO recently, and I liked her in Blaze of Glory with Will Ferrell, and she's funny, but I find her, I'm not a huge fan of hers, and I've watched Parks and Recreation, and she has this flaw, as she did when she did Weekend Update and other things on SNL, where she telegraphs the joke.
Right.
You know, she smirks. She gives like this knowing smirk, and it's a crummy acting job. And NBC, though, seems to embrace that style. And it's almost like anybody coming from SNL now almost gets to do whatever they want to do on NBC. And they must feel like, well, maybe we didn't love that first flight of episodes of Parks and Recreation, but it has Amy Poehler, and she's really of the moment now. And she is. And look what they did with Tina Fey.
Yep.
I mean, and then you could say, well, they did a great thing with Tina Fey. You see, I think as much as I love The Office, I think 30 Rock is the quality sitcom on TV now. There's something so bright and clever about that show.
It's got some great characters.
It doesn't get the ratings, gets all the awards.
Yep.
Doesn't have a mass audience. Now, as I say this, I'm recalling that in the last 2 days have come announcements from the NBC Universal Syndication Company, and 30 Rock has gone through the moon, selling in repeats that will start airing in 2011 on local stations.
Okay.
So NBC, if someone was standing here from NBC, they would say, well, Adam, you know, I'm hearing what you're telling Rick Morris on the radio about our show. I'm here to tell you, we just made, you know, $500 million or something. So, you know, the television business is complicated.
Well, maybe they
And they're not in it to lose money. So
I sometimes
think they probably have a better handle on it than I would.
Well, that, you know,
I do.
They could be justified in thinking they're going to make their money down the road. I mean, for as much as everybody looks back at Scarface, you know, it wasn't so much what it did at the box office that made the legend. It was everything that came thereafter.
That's right. And it wasn't even that good a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nobody really liked Scarface when it came out, did they?
Right.
We all used to laugh at Al Pacino.
Exactly. By the way, I just ripped off that last take from Entourage. I didn't know what box office it did before I saw it on there.
Okay.
But, yeah, that is the case. You know, Adam, as we look at this here again, you've got your great column at TV Week. You've got your aforementioned blog there with the only billing that I think you really would deserve as far as the best TV writer going today. Between
That's really
TV
nice.
Week, TV Howl, anything else that you got going on that you'd like to plug? Because we always give everybody a chance to plug on this show.
Well, I appreciate that a lot. I don't have anything to announce at the moment, but I hope to resurface soon, perhaps at a newspaper or a magazine, and I'll send you an email, I promise.
Well,
okay?
That would be great. And I tell you what, too, I want to tell you what I said to one of our other East Coast-based writers that we had on tonight, a gentleman named Lloyd Carroll with the Queens Chronicle. I want to say the same thing.
I know Lloyd.
Yeah, it's weird. It was like 6 degrees of separation. You guys, Abe Madcore from Sports Business Journal, who I know at least Lloyd had crossed paths with. It's, you know, very incestuous, the group of people we'd had on tonight. You all have been great guests. What I'd like to do, we've got an episode in 2 weeks here called The Pantheon. Every year we vote on the best of the best in sports and pop culture and everything like that.
Oh.
I'd like to email you a ballot and have you among our list of, our jury for the votes that will be announced that night there. It would be an honor to be able to count you among our
voters.
Well,
you're really nice. I would love to do that for you.
I would love that.
That would be a lot of fun.
I'd love to get your takes on these things. That would be tremendous. And Adam, it would
Can
be
Can I come back on the show?
Oh, yeah. I'd love to have you back on the show here at some point. Absolutely.
Okay.
That would be tremendous. Will that be possible?
Oh, probably.
All right. Well,
I never go anywhere.
Probably. That sounds like a concrete commitment to me and to the listeners there, Adam.
Exactly.
So we'll make it happen here at some point. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
it's been great
Rick,
to
so
have
much.
You.
That was a lot of fun. Great
it was.
Interview. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Adam. Adam Buckman, everybody.
Good night.
From TV Week and TV Howl, respectively.